This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Profits were unprecedented on Wall Street during the 1980s, but by the end of the decade, the stock market had crashed, the country was in a recession, and some of the stars of Wall Street were in prison. We now know that many of the most profitable deals of the 80s were based on insider trading and other illegal financial maneuvers. Reporter James Stewart describes it as the greatest criminal conspiracy the financial world has ever known. Stewart covered the insider trading scandal for the Wall Street Journal, and he's written a new book that reveals in new detail arrangements and deals among the perpetrators, Dennis Levine, Ivan Boesky, Martin Siegel, and Michael Milken. Stewart spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet about the findings in his new book, Den of Thieves.
Dennis Levine was the first major figure in your book who was investigated by the SEC, and he was charged with trading with inside information. Can you just give us an example of the type of illegal activity that he was engaged in?
Well, he did a lot of it. He earned, in the SEC's estimate, over $12 million in illegal profits. But the way it worked is, in one of the most dramatic instances, he got his colleague, his co-conspirator, Lazard Frere, to let him into the offices of Lazard Frere late on a Friday night. And they swept through the offices, and he actually stole confidential documents about an upcoming takeover by a big French oil company of a U.S. oil company. They then used that information to buy the stocks trading in advance of a big takeover deal. Now, I hope most people understand that, you know, a stock may be trading at one level. The minute a takeover offer comes in, those stock prices just soar. In some cases, they double. So there's tremendous opportunity to make profit there. But he systematically seized information from his own employer and from this ring of co-conspirators he put together at other firms.
How would he do that? Would he approach people that would have information, or how would he get information?
Well, he was an investment banker, so he was hired at his own firm to advise companies who were interested in making takeovers. So he, as an investment banker, would be one of the very first people to know that there was going to be a hostile deal. Now, that information is supposed to be kept strictly secret, but he shared it with his co-conspirators they called it the game, and it was kind of right out of a Hardy Boys mystery or some kind of bad spy novel. They had code words, and they got together at fancy restaurants, and they had all these little routines to maintain their identity secret. But then with his conspirators at other firms, like a lawyer at a big takeover law firm, he too, because there are always legal questions, would be hired by a company about to be taken over or about to launch a takeover bid. So he'd know, and then he'd pass that information on to Dennis, and he'd then secretly buy stock through his Swiss bank account in the Bahamas.
It seems like there are a lot of people on Wall Street who are privy to inside information. So has this been going on for a long time, or did something happen in the 80s that made it run rampant?
Well, something happened in the 80s. One thing that happened was the rise of the really huge hostile takeover deal, and some of them weren't even hostile. Even in doing the research in my book, I was surprised to see that the first hostile takeover only happened in 1974, which isn't that long ago. And the big money really only kicked in once the Reagan administration policies were in effect that encouraged very large mergers in this country. So the big deals were rolling in the early 80s, which meant that if you had the secret information, you could make more money on it than ever had been thought possible before. Now, at the same time, I have to say, yes, of course, many people on Wall Street had this, and they had always been entrusted with it on the expectation that we'd maintain strict secrecy around it. And I, as a journalist, was writing about mergers in the mid-80s, and anyone could see that something had broken down because the prices of these stocks would leap up long before there was any public disclosure of what was about to happen. So I knew, and a lot of people knew, that somehow this stuff was leaking out.
Another person who made millions by using inside information was Ivan Boesky.
Yes.
And he was a very successful arbitrageur on Wall Street. And as you say, there was a lot of suspicion on Wall Street that he was trading with inside information because he was just right too much of the time.
Too much, absolutely.
And he seemed to always know which companies were going to be the target of a hostile takeover because he would buy large amounts of their stock.
Huge amounts.
Before the takeover bid became public. So Wasn't he being careless? I mean, wasn't it really obvious what was going on?
Well, with the benefit of hindsight, he did become careless. I call the first half of the book Above the Law, though, because I think that explains the mindset that had set in here. You see these people, they do it on a small scale and get away with it, and then they do it a little bit bigger and get away with it. And then in the case of Boesky, they just did it in a huge way, and they thought they were getting away with that. So it was extraordinary, the millions he would pour in this, and he thought he was invincible. And indeed he was, until Dennis Levine turned out to be one of his intimate co-conspirators who was able to implicate him.
Can you give us an idea of the enormity of Boesky's wealth? Can you describe how he lived?
Well, he lived lavishly. One of the stories I stumbled upon that just continues to amaze me is that he'd go into a restaurant and the waiter would, you know, tick off the days, an expensive restaurant too, and the waiter would tick off the specials of the day, and Boesky would say, "I'll have them all." He'd order all of them. They'd have to wheel out a separate table with every dish on it. Then Boesky would go around, taste each one, pick one, send all the rest back, and yet have to pay for everything on the menu. And that was small compared to the money he spent on helicopters. He's late to a party. He gets dropped on board the Queen Elizabeth II on a helicopter. He's trying to talk his friend John Mulhern into having Bruce Springsteen flown up to his house so his kids can have dinner with him. He has his lavish estate in Mount Kisco, the tennis court with the inflatable bubble, the squash courts with a roof that would cantilever back on it, the carpeting with his initials embossed. I mean, it just goes on and on and on, living very, very lavishly. And he had tremendous amounts of money. When he was finally caught, he was required to submit a confidential statement to the government, which I disclose in the book for the first time. And at that, he revealed his net worth there to be $125 million. But that doesn't include all of the money that his wife has, and she was very wealthy in her own right, plus all the trust funds and foundations that he established on behalf of his children. So even after paying his $100 million fine, Boesky, by that calculation, has at least $25 million left over.
My guest is James Stewart. His new book on the insider trading scandal is called Den of Thieves. Out of the four people that you write about in your book, you portray Michael Milken, who was the junk bond king at Drexel Burnham Lambert, as being the greediest and the most powerful player in this big criminal conspiracy. And can you briefly tell us what junk bonds are and how Milken used them and made them so profitable?
Well, junk bonds are like any other bond, the difference being that they yield a high interest rate, which is meant to compensate for the fact that they're the kinds of companies where the risk is greater. They're the kinds of companies that probably couldn't go to a J.P. Morgan and get an ordinary bank loan because they're younger, they're smaller, they're growing, their balance sheets aren't as firm. There's simply more risk. Now, Milken's theory, which he derived from other academic experts, was that the higher interest rate would more than compensate for the increased risk of taking on these bonds. And if there was genius in Milken, it was his ability to sell many, many, many investors on the idea that he could bring them higher returns if they invest in these so-called junk bonds. He was enormously successful. The market was something like $120 billion at its peak.
Michael Milken began working with Ivan Boesky at one point. And though Boesky had always been seen as being a really powerful and debonair figure on Wall Street, you show him in your book as being a manipulated pawn of Michael Milken.
Let me start by explaining the basis of the relationship, because you've got to understand that to understand why Milken could control Boesky. Boesky had been a failure in his life at almost everything he did. He was a failure as an arbitrageur until he started getting inside information. Once he had the inside information to capitalize on it, he needed more money to throw out the deals, and the only place he went could go for that was Milken. Milken financed Boesky. Boesky borrowed money from Milken, over $100 million in Milken-generated money. Boesky had to pay an annual interest rate of 17% on that money, which meant Boesky had to use that money to generate really big returns. And that made him even more dependent on the inside information. Now, Milken at the same time could pull the plug on those bonds. He could have wiped out Boesky at any time he wanted by simply demanding repayment of those notes. Eventually, Boesky dug himself in deeper and deeper and deeper, eventually borrowing $650 million through Milken. That was the underlying basis of his dependence on Milken. Now, the way they worked together in Milken's schemes was to use a combination of insider trading and coercive tactics to force these big hostile takeover deals. I think maybe the best example, if I could point to it, was the Pacific Lumber transaction. There, Milken ordered Boesky to take a large position of stock in Pacific Lumber, which is a company that one of Milken's clients wanted to take over. And Milken himself secretly owned the stock on a 50-50 basis with Boesky, even though Milken was banned from trading in the stock of his clients or the target of his clients. So what happened is a Pacific Lumber would wake up one day and it'd see its stock price starting to go up. It'd get a hostile bid from Milken's client. Meanwhile, Boesky surfaced publicly saying, I own over 5% of your stock, and I'm a fearsome raider with plenty of money. I may try to take you over. Now, who would you rather be owned by, the notorious Ivan Boesky, or at least a relatively friendly corporate acquirer backed by Mike Milken? Pacific Lumber panicked and said, we'll take the Milken deal. So then they sold the company at a big profit. Now, here's how Milken made money. Boesky's stock obviously went way up when the takeover deal went through. Milken got half the profits. More importantly, Milken financed the deal and took a big percentage of the total cost, which meant he got many, many more millions in financing fees. And finally, in most of these deals, Milken would extract some stock at a very low cost that he got to keep. And then if the company did well afterwards, that soared in value. So he raked in many, many millions. He told, when he recruited one of his assistants, a guy named Taran Pizer, he said to him, Taran, I'm going to show more ways that you can make money than you ever believed possible.
How were they able to get away with this? Was much of this due to deregulation?
A good deal of it was due to deregulation. The merger wave would never have happened if the antitrust laws hadn't essentially been ignored during the Reagan administration. The first act of the Reagan Justice Department was to drop the antitrust case against IBM, which I think sent a message to corporate America that just about anything goes. Now, the securities laws were also pretty moribund. When some of the charges began to be filed against these people, they were all screaming, saying, well, nobody ever filed charges on this before. Why are you singling me out? And there had been a lot of inactivity on that front. But I will give credit to the civil servants, the head of enforcement at the SEC, Gary Lynch, and the hardworking prosecutors in the Justice Department. Once confronted with this level of crime and very much outspent and outmanned by the Milken forces, persevered and didn't bring these guys to justice.
You say that in your book that the magnitude of the illegal gains was so large that it was incomprehensible to the layman. Could you throw some figures at us?
Yeah,
how much were they making?
Well, it's staggering. Take Milken in the year 1986. That year, he was paid from Drexel $550 million in salary and bonus. He had more than 500 secret investment partnerships run out of the Beverly Hills office. One of those that I was able to analyze and get the records of paid out more than $400 million that year. That gets us up almost to a billion. Finally, that same year, he had extracted these warrants to buy stock in the Beatrice deal, a takeover that he spawned. And I calculate the value of those warrants in 1986 at $650 million. Now, we're looking at one of hundreds of deals, one of hundreds of partnerships, and 1 year's earnings, and we're up to almost $2 billion.
You also say that Drexel Burnham Lambert could raise billions of dollars almost overnight. Now, how would Milken pull that together?
He had a network of what I call captive clients. Basically, they did what he told them to do. They were variations of Boesky, although in many cases they had even more money at their disposal. And they included a network of six now failed savings and loans. And Milken would call up and say, look, I want a commitment of $500 million for you on, say, the Union Carbide deal. In Union Carbide, he did raise over $5 billion in a single weekend. And again, they were beholden to him because they all owned these savings and loans, for example, and then there were insurance companies involved as well, Executive Life being the biggest. They had huge portfolios of his junk bonds. Now, he was the only person who made markets in these bonds. So let's say they needed to liquefy their assets. They only had Milken to turn to. If he said, oh, I can't find a buyer for you today, they were stuck. They were ruined. On the other hand, he could find buyers for them at profits, and he would generate through trading their bonds. Generate very lucrative returns for these institutions while the game was still going on.
My guest is James Stewart. He's the front page editor at the Wall Street Journal and author of a new book on the insider trading scandal called Den of Thieves. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Reporter James Stewart is my guest. The bulk of Milken's money was made when Drexel financed finance these hostile takeovers. Can you describe the impact that a hostile takeover would typically have on the company that was taken over? Would they be strengthened financially by this merger, or were there problems?
Oh, certainly not. There were many problems that ensued from this. Let me again use Pacific Lumber as an example. Pacific Lumber is a manufacturer of wood products, particularly redwood products, and owned at one time the largest tracts of virgin redwood forests in North America. Now, after the takeover, the acquirer had borrowed huge amounts of money in these junk bonds and had to pay the interest on these bonds at very high interest rates. So how did it do it? Two ways. It had to reduce costs, and that meant firing many workers. I mean, cutting the workforce absolutely to the bone. Thousands and thousands of Americans lost their jobs so that the cost could be reduced to pay debt. How else did they do it? They boosted output. They started felling the redwood forest at a rate that environmentalists in California have since alleged was a ruinous activity and environmentally hazardous. And those battles are still going on.
You say that the financial crimes of Milken and Boesky were not victimless crimes. Can you talk about some of the other victims?
Well, on the broadest level, all of us are victims. The capital raising formation process in this country depends on a marketplace that people are willing to entrust with their money, whether it's directly through stock purchases or indirectly through the investments of pension funds and other organizations. And if that confidence is shattered, eventually then, I mean, you could see a world in which people would go back to only like putting their money in mattresses or something, then this economy would collapse. It is important, I believe, that people feel that they're given a fair shake, that this economy rewards merit, because if that is lost, then capitalism itself, I think, is in danger. And the history of the free market is that without careful attention to the laws that govern it, that the free markets end up ruining and destroying themselves. That's at a very broad level. At a narrower level, more direct level, take the savings and loans I talked about before that have now all collapsed. Milken is certainly not alone to blame for the magnitude of the savings and loan disaster, but you can lay billions of dollars in losses directly at his feet, and the taxpayers are now paying for all of that. In addition, there's all the problems because of the debt overhang in the economy, the current recession, which even President Bush is now saying because people aren't borrowing, companies aren't borrowing enough, investing in research and development, new products and whatnot. Well, the reason they can't do that is because they're still paying off this huge overhang of debt left over from the 80s. And that is curbing growth in the economy and holding down employment and wage levels right now. And of course, there are the direct losers, the people who unwittingly sold their stock into people like Boesky, Milken, their allies, who were in possession illegally of inside information.
After charges were made against Michael Milken, he hired a public relations company to help him win favor in the public eye. What kinds of things did they have him do?
It was just amazing to me. I don't think there's ever been a criminal case where a criminal defendant mounted such a massive attempt to affect public opinion. I almost have to laugh at this, but at one point, Drexel, who was paying the bills under an agreement with Milken, had to put him on a budget of $1.2 million a month in expenses on legal and PR charges. He was spending over $3 million a month. Now, I can't...
On what? What was he spending?
Well, you know, I can't really answer that. I'd love to know exactly. But it was a massive campaign in which there were enormous numbers of Milken allies. The PR organization would churn out, you know, op-ed pieces that would then be signed by Milken loyalists so that you'd read an op-ed piece from, say, the chairman of MCI Communications thinking that he had written that when, in fact, it was all written by the Milken organization. They would fly a journalist out to Beverly Hills for very carefully controlled kind of personality interviews with Milken. The charitable giving soared. Milken is always touting his record with charitable activities, but I looked very closely at his record of charitable giving, and almost all of it comes from the moment he was became a target of investigation and was obviously trying to court public opinion. I think the most cynical aspect of this was the cultivation of the black community. Once it became clear that Milken was likely to be tried before a Manhattan jury, which would have a large number of minorities given the makeup of the city, suddenly Milken developed this great interest in civil rights and was attending fundraising dinners for Jesse Jackson and hosting charity events for underprivileged children and having photo opportunities taken with young black children. One of those pictures is included in the book. you know, I'm glad he discovered that there were ways to spend his money other than on further enriching himself. But I do find it very cynical that this was all an attempt to affect the outcome of a criminal proceeding.
He's in prison now. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison, and I guess he's working in maintenance and construction. Yet the public relations effort is continuing.
Oh, and absolutely.
He's hired lawyer Alan Dershowitz, and what does he want him to do?
As I understand it, most recently, Dershowitz has been considering efforts to reduce the length of Milken's sentence, and has been thinking even of going so far as to claim that Milken was in fact not guilty of the six felonies to which he pleaded guilty, trying to find a way to undo that guilty plea. I think it shows the level of denial which Milken has been practicing almost from the day the investigation began.
This lawyer who he's hired recently, Alan Dershowitz, recently attacked your book, and he called it a vicious anti-Semitic diatribe. Have you spoken with him directly about this?
No, I haven't, and I don't want to foster his clearly obfuscatory, diversionary campaign, but I will say it's a very painful charge to me. I think it's absolutely false, and no one who has read the book has suggested in any way that there is any element of anti-Semitism in that. And I find it particularly painful because I see Mr. Dershowitz is now trying to inflame the very kind of prejudice which I personally find repugnant, and I think which people who read the book will find is actually dispelled.
Do these kinds of crimes, are they still going on Wall Street, do you think, or have there been new laws and stronger enforcement instituted?
Well, I think the good news is that the massive levels of insider trading that were going on are not happening now. That's partly a function of the reduced number of takeovers, but also I think there was a lesson that was absorbed by the fact that these four kingpins of insider trading did get caught and brought to some kind of justice. On the other hand, in the epilogue to the book, I kind of talk about can this happen again, and I speculate that, in fact, something like this will happen again, although in a different genre. Well, I didn't know anything about the Salomon scandal in the Treasury market at the time, but I must say I'm somewhat dismayed to see that prophecy coming true so quickly in another area of financing, not junk bonds this time, but in what was considered the very hallowed, safe, and honest market of U.S. Treasury bonds.
James Stewart, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
James Stewart spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. Stewart is the front page editor of the Wall Street Journal. His new book on the insider trading scandal is called Den of Thieves. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.